Welcome back to the Interlude Podcast. You are listening to episode 152, A Conversation with Nazreen Shahi. Nazreen is the writer of Hey Nazreen. She is a blogger and an incredible fashion and beauty creator. She is a native Texan and lives in Austin with her husband and three kids. 2 years ago, Nazreen was diagnosed with stage 4 triple positive breast cancer. And she's here with me on this episode to talk about all of it. She takes us back to the days of that original diagnosis, finding out that what was initially thought to be stage 3 breast cancer had metastasized, her reaction in that moment, jumping into action to get her workup, to get treatment. She talks about her initial chemotherapy, what cold capping was like, and how she felt beautiful even on those darker days. We talk about what life has been like in the last 2 years, her advocacy to find a surgical team that would help her achieve the results that she wanted, mental health, navigating work throughout treatment, navigating parenting, and so much more. It is an honor to have Nazreen here. And as we wrap up Breast Cancer Awareness Month, I urge you to remember that breast cancer awareness is not only in October. Breast cancer action occurs all year round. And it is so important that we continue to talk about breast cancer awareness, diagnosis, raise funds for research, because it is research that improves outcomes. And on that note, my two top organizations to donate to are Breast Cancer Research Foundation and MetaViver. I am personally running the New York City Marathon and fundraising for the Pink Agenda, which is a subsidiary of BCRF. So that's also another great research organization that supports funds and action and empowerment for the AYA, adolescent and young adult population. Thank you for listening. And with that, it is my honor to welcome Nazreen Shahi to the Interlude Podcast.
I'm your host, Dr. Eleanor Toplinski, and I am a board-certified medical oncologist specializing in the treatment of breast and gynecologic cancers. I started the Interlude Podcast as a way to share the journeys and experiences of women who are going through cancer. On this podcast, we talk about anything and everything related to the cancer journey, the treatment, and life after cancer. As a reminder, the information discussed on this podcast is not meant to serve as medical advice. Any specific medical questions should be directed to your healthcare team.
Nazreen, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Can you start by just sharing a little bit about who you are and your breast cancer diagnosis and story?
Sure. So my name is Nazreen, and I am a now 42-year-old mom of three kiddos. I have three kids who are 13, 9, and 7. I am mostly known for my social media page, which I have a fashion and beauty and lifestyle blog where I've, for the last almost 7 years, shared just everyday fashion for the everyday girl and really have an amazing community and network of women that in the end ended up carrying me through just like a really hard time in my life. My first mammogram, I was 40 years old and found out that I not only had breast cancer, but soon after found out that it was metastatic breast cancer.
When you went for that first mammogram, were you expecting anything, or was it, okay, I'm 40, routine mammogram?
I was truly not expecting anything. I had very large, dense breasts, so it wasn't unusual for my providers to sometimes be like, oh, this kind of feels different, or that kind of feels different. And I did need a referral for whatever reason to get my mammogram. And I was due for, it was the year of COVID. So everybody was behind on their appointments and I couldn't get in. So it was August instead of, you know, I think I was due in March for my annual gynecology exam. And I saw her in August. And she was like, you know, you're due for your mammogram anyway, since you have dense breasts, let's just go ahead and go for a 3D mammogram. And because your age and, you know, all the, you know, your breasts are always changing and those sorts of things. So I truly thought nothing. I think I waited actually like a week to even call to make my mammogram after she sent the referral. And then by the time I even got in for that mammogram, it was then the end of September. So about six to eight weeks went by from when I saw my provider to when I got my mammogram.
And can you talk a little bit about those emotions that getting that call that the mammogram was abnormal to, you know, through a diagnosis of metastatic breast cancer? Because that's, you know, that's a lot.
It was so much, and it was so shocking, and every day felt like a bigger blow. So I actually left there kind of knowing, because the radiologist had sent me back and forth into the room a few times, and then he called me into his room, and unfortunately his bedside manner wasn't great. And the way he delivered the news was like, listen, I'm pretty sure you have breast cancer and you need to see somebody like today to get a biopsy. Like, I mean, he obviously couldn't get in that day. Well, I wish I could have, but I didn't. That was on a Friday, I believe. And it took just a couple days to get in to get a biopsy with, and a friend of a friend had a friend who's a breast radiologist here in Austin, Dr. Erin Winston, who is literally incredible. And she made sure to get me in and kind of do what she had described as, we're going to be able to gather as much information here so that we don't have to drag this out longer. So she was able to do a contrast mammogram, a ultrasound and in-office biopsy all in that same day. So we got a lot of data at that time. What's interesting is about all this, or crazy, not interesting, but my sister-in-law was diagnosed with breast cancer about 2 weeks before this. Wow. So, and I, in that appointment, had found out more than she was able to find out in those 2 weeks. So that is like one thing that I wish more people knew about, because I get a lot of people contact me about like, what do I do next? And I feel like finding a place that a breast radiology center was so critical for me. And I feel like really got the ball rolling so quickly. So, got that biopsy on a Monday. Wednesday got the call that it was breast cancer. Both she biopsied my lymph node and my right breast, which is where they saw, you know, concerning spots. And then Friday I was in an oncologist's office, and at that point we had thought it was stage 3 breast cancer, which in my mind meant I was dying already. That was what I believed, because Everything I knew about cancer was like in my mind, stage 3, 4, like that's it. Like this is not going to go well. And then she did a physical exam and was like, you know, your liver feels a little hardened. Do you have, I can't remember what she asked me if I had, exposure to, I can't remember, to be honest, but it was something I was like, no, you know, or hepatitis, I think it was something like along those lines. Mm-hmm. I was like, no. So she's like, okay, well, we always do a PET scan once it's in your lymph node. So we're going to go ahead and schedule that, but we are not waiting for that information. We need to get started. Like now we're going to have your port placed. We're going to have this. So this is like literally all in one appointment. And within a week of mammogram to diagnosis, I was like, had a port placement scheduled. I had, you know, I was literally in shock, like just pure shock.
So. And how do you go with all this, right? All these appointments, and then go be a mom of 3 and have to think about dinner and homework?
I feel like the best way to describe it is like you're a ghost of yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going through the motions, but you're not actually present in any way, shape, or form. I definitely took a step back from social media. People were worried and people were like, where are you? Are you okay? And I just couldn't come on and share it yet. It was like so much. Yeah. And I didn't even know what exactly was happening yet. So I felt like I just wasn't ready to share. And I remember I had a wedding that weekend of a good friend, and I was like, how do I go and be there? And I just remember being like, because like life has to go on still. I have to live the life that I have now. Same thing with my kids. So I went, kind of funny, but right when I left that oncology appointment, I walked out and called my eyebrow person, was like, I need you to microblade my eyebrows. And I don't know why I thought of that of all the things, but I think that set the tone of how I was going to be, which was a box checker. I decided I'm going to do everything I'm supposed to do. I'm going to go get my eyebrows microbladed. I'm going to go do my PET scan. I'm going to figure out my wig. I'm going to figure out cold capping. It became almost like a checklist situation for me, which I think helped me mentally so much. Like taking it piece by piece and being like, okay, first I need to conquer this. Then I need to do this. I need to do this. And I became almost robotic, which confused a lot of people. But I think for me, it helped me so much in getting through it.
Yeah, because I think it's so overwhelming. You know, when I talk to people and when I do that consult and we go through all the things that, you know, everything that you just mentioned, right, that you need to do, it's so overwhelming. So I think breaking it down into things that you can control, right? You can control getting your eyebrows microbladed. You can control scheduling the PET scan. It kind of puts a little bit on you rather than everything that's happening to you at that point.
That's exactly right. I felt completely out of control and I felt like completely betrayed by my own body in so many ways, because I was probably in the best physical shape I had ever been in my life when I was diagnosed. And so I just thought it was so crazy. I've always eaten so well. I've always exercised the last few years, especially after having kids, it became such a big part of my life. So I was going to Orange Theory 5 days a week. I was really feeling so good and healthy. So it was just so shocking and I felt very out of control. So I think being able to do the small things that I could control was helpful to me.
It makes a big difference. You get the PET scan and I'm assuming they called you with the results.
Yeah, she called me and I remember my husband had left the house to go. He barely left me alone during this time because I felt extremely dependent on him. And I felt very, you know, like I said, like a ghost of myself, almost somebody physically carrying you, even though it's more just emotionally, you know. I remember he left to go pick up my son from basketball and my sister was there with the kids and my phone rang and I was like, I gotta go. And I went into my room and I closed the door and she said, are you alone? And I said, yes. And she said, is your husband there? And I said, no. And she was like, can you call me back when he gets there? And I said, no, like, tell me now. And she said, I'm sorry, we see widespread metastatic disease in your liver. And I was like, what does that mean? Like, what does that mean? And she was like, you have metastatic breast cancer. And I just was, I think I just blacked out. I don't even quite remember, but I just remember being like, I'm going to die, you know? And she was, you know, like, we have amazing medication and we are, you know, you're going to fight as hard as you can. And, you know, all these things. And I remember hearing her say these things and like being like, you're lying. Like, that's not going to happen. And I remember like losing hope for a moment there, but I remember then my husband coming and we were both just sobbing. My sister was there. It was just complete devastation across my entire family. Because again, I was 40 years old, had no family history of breast cancer. One, no symptoms of breast cancer, it was just such a shock, you know, as I'm sure it is to everybody who goes through this.
And then I think that's why it's so important to have these conversations, so people know that they're not alone. Because I think sometimes I hear from people that they feel like they shouldn't react the way that they did. And I think there is no right way to handle those news. When you lost that hope, how did you get it back?
So the day after she gave me that information, she said, we also need to do a brain MRI. And I was like, oh God, like, here we go again. Like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I cannot take any more bad news. So we did the brain MRI and the day we got the results was the day that I started chemo. And we walked into the room and the nurse walked in and she walked in before the doctor. I think she just could see on our faces and she goes, your brain scan is clear. And we just literally, like, it can make me tear up now because it was just like the first glimmer of hope, you know?
Mm-hmm. And you need those glimmers.
Yeah. I think at that point we had just gotten bad news after bad news after bad news. And so I expected bad news. And when we didn't get bad news, I was like, okay, like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be okay. Like, I just kept telling myself, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be okay. And my husband would tell me that over and over and over. I think that kind of started the trend of getting my hope back. And there in that time, I had also had a liver biopsy, even though we were confident that it was cancer, they still had to do the biopsy. So I think it was the day after I started chemo that we found that out. It was like the week after we got the liver biopsy back, and it had already showed like 99% necrotic from the biopsy. And that was another glimmer of hope. And there was just, already. Yeah, it was, I just told myself, as much as I hated the chemo and as much as I hated seeing my hair fall out and all these things, that this cancer was working, and this cancer was going to keep me alive. And this cancer was going to fight. This chemo was going to fight the cancer that I had. And so I just kept telling myself that. And I felt like we were getting little glimmers of hope, that kept me going. And in the end, it's your family. You know, you look at your kids. My daughter was 5 at that time. I was like, there's no way this is going to be her story. Like, this is not going to be her story. And I just kept telling myself that, and it made me hopeful.
And what did you tell your kids?
Oh yeah. So, we waited to tell them until before I started chemo. I had reached out to an organization called Wonders and Worries here in Austin. And I'm not sure if I think they do have nationwide capabilities, meaning they can reach patients virtually everywhere, but they really help families go through this, how to talk about things. They have these, we signed them up for coming in person. There was like 6 sessions that they provide for free that are like play-based therapy, basically. And it was so good for my kids, but I had talked to them before and was like, how do I do this? Like, what's the right way? Cause my son is older and my daughter is young. You know, my son was at that time, I think 11, and my daughter my youngest was 5. So there's a big age difference and a big understanding difference. So what we decided to tell them is that I have cancer, I have breast cancer, and that I'm starting treatment for it, and that we feel confident that the treatment is going to kill the cancer. And that while they might see me look different and look sick, it's not because of the cancer, but it's because of the chemo that's killing the cancer. I think that was an important part that Wonders and Worries taught me, was like, if they see you sick, they're going to think the cancer is doing that to you. And it's important to explain to them the medication is doing that to you. And these are the side effects. So that was really helpful for me and them as well. Their reaction was shock. And my son, who is older, was like, are you going to die? And I said, no, I'm not. And I believed that when I said it. I was like, no, I'm not. I know I'm not. I just know that this is not it. So anyway, that's how we told them. And it was a hard time. But we're really lucky. We have a lot of family here and a lot of family support. And I felt like my sisters really stepped up. My best friends really stepped up, and the grandparents, everybody tried to do everything so that their normalcy didn't change.
Yeah. And I really like that perspective of the chemo doing it to you. So it's killing the cancer. I think that's really important for kids because, you know, I can see the associations. So what was chemo like? And in terms of how this interplayed with your role and as in, you know, being on social media and fashion and beauty and blogging, like how did all that come together?
So when I first found out, I decided I was going to most likely like pause my account and not, because I was like, how am I supposed to come on here where people come to me for like beauty and fashion advice? And it is the complete opposite at this time. And I really pride myself on having a positive space, and I didn't want people to come there and feel sad. And I didn't want people feeling sorry for me. Didn't want people to see me looking sick. There were so many emotions. But then once I shared my diagnosis, I very quickly realized like, this is the best circle of sisterhood you could imagine. And what better good to do with my pain than to create awareness and raise awareness and reach an audience that maybe wouldn't have been reached, you know? It really helped me so much going through chemo, because the encouragement and the stories of other survivors and just the connections that I had with all these women was so strong. And it really did help me so much. And I also, to this day, people reach out to me and say, I got my first mammogram and found out I have cancer because of you. Like, if I didn't see your story, I would have never gone at 40, or I would have ignored the lump at 32. And I found out early because of you. And I, you know, just so many things. And I'm like, this is, you know, I'm not a super religious person, but I kept telling myself this was in God's plan. Like, this is why this happened to me, so I can help somebody else.
And I am sure you have helped so many people, because there is, I mean, there's so much also out there about not getting mammograms and misinformation. And I think seeing, you know, why mammograms are important and how it helped you get your diagnosis, I think really hopefully will has inspired so many people to go and, yep, I need to get tested. I need to get that mass checked out.
And I think also just the self-check awareness, like I was not one to do self-breast exams. I just wasn't. I didn't really know how very well. And when I thought I was doing it, now I know that that was really not the correct way. Yeah, I think that there's a lot of awareness to bring out and also a lot of stigma to break through. Culturally, there are a lot of people who do not share this type of stuff. They keep it, like there are people that reached out that told me that they, nobody but their husband knew that they went through breast cancer because they didn't want their families and public to know, because then somebody may not want to marry their daughter or just crazy things that I was like really blown away by how people get through things like this on its own. So I feel like I helped in some ways break that stigma amongst certain types of cultures and things like that. So, but in terms of going through chemo while sharing on social media, I decided at that point, I am going to share this and I'm going to share every single part of it. I'm going to share the really bad stuff, but I'm also going to share the highs and, you know, cause yeah, there were highs along the way. And so, yeah, that's what I did. I started cold capping, which is something that I was really thankful to be able to do. I had mild success, I would say, with it, but I still think it was good for me mentally. And I saved maybe like 20% of my hair. I did wear a wig throughout when I was doing things for like campaigns for work and things like that. But other than that, I was hell bent on still feeling good about myself during that time. And another, I think that's another thing that really helped me mentally, is I would get up and put my makeup on. I'd draw a darker eyeliner on so that I looked like I still had my eyelashes. I would, you know, style my hair in a way that you couldn't tell that 80% of it was gone. And I just kind of shared, I continued to work. I continued to share outfits and beauty. And looking back, I'm like, wow, that was actually really crazy. How did I do that? I don't know how I did.
But it, you know, I think that normalcy is important too, right? To go through. And for some people, I think having other things to focus on is really, really important. That's why I always tell people, they're like, should I stop working? I said, just wait, see how it goes, see how you feel. Cause I think work can be really empowering in that time.
Yeah. And that's what my oncologist said as well. I was like, do I need to stop working? And she was like, there's absolutely no reason for you to stop working right now. You need to do everything, as get, create as much normalcy for yourself as you can, because your mental health is 50% of this battle. And I was like, and I cannot agree with that more. I think the mental, obviously there's a lot we can't control, but our mental health we can control to some extent. And I feel like I was able to do that.
You know, one of the things that I hear a lot from people is, you know, they don't feel beautiful during treatment. You know, their hair is gone, their eyebrows are gone. They, a lot of body, you know, of course, body image, if they have a mastectomy, we could talk about that. But how, what advice would you have as someone who is, you know, an expert in this space for feeling a little bit more beautiful on those dark days?
I used to tell myself too, this, like, I'm just going to fake it till I make it. I'm going to feel like I'm going to do the best I can physically. I'm going to do that eyeliner. I'm going to style my hair this way, put on my lipstick and blush and all the things I can. And that is going to make me feel good. And that in the end is going to make me feel pretty still, you know? And I think that's what it was. It was like, I truly did not, I looked like a shell of myself. I did not look like myself. Everybody else would be like, I can barely tell. And I'm like, that's nice, but I look completely different to me. And there would be people that would say that all the time. Like, I would have never known what you were going through. But I guess my advice to somebody going through it is don't give up. Don't give up, you know, do what you can to feel good about yourself. And that may, maybe that doesn't mean lipstick to somebody else, but it meant it to me. You know, maybe it means, you know, being physically active still during that time, or maybe it could mean something different, but there is so, it, cancer strips you of so much. And I think I was able to maintain some of my confidence, which made me still feel good about myself.
I think that's the key. It's that confidence, right? Because that's also such a part that for many people is lost, especially, you know, we talk about your body betraying you and all the side effects. And so when you finished chemo, what was the trajectory after that?
So at that point, I had a full response as far as they could tell. Like they couldn't see anything on any scans. And so my doctor was like, I do advise that you do the mastectomy, because initially they wouldn't really tell me that that was going to happen. They would be like, that's best case scenario. We go forward with the double mastectomy and your reconstruction and all of those things. So this is a big piece of my story, and I would like to share it if that's okay with you, but this is where I really learned about self-advocacy and really being your own advocate when it comes to your health. Cause I felt like I had limited options in Austin, Texas, where I live. And I decided to get consultations elsewhere. I really wanted to avoid implants. And I was told a few times that I wasn't a candidate for the deep flap. And I ended up flying out to Los Angeles and doing my surgery with Dr. Divya Srinivasa, who I feel like you guys might
know.
And my consult with her was another time where I felt so hopeful, because she was the first one to be like, we can do this. Like we can't, it's not, you know, the conventional route that surgeons take, but we can do your mastectomy and your deep flap at the same time. We can, you know, so I flew out to LA, stayed there for 3 weeks, did my surgery there. I got my ovaries removed at that time as well. So it was a pretty big surgery. The mastectomy with Dr. Christy Funk, who is incredible, reconstruction with Dr. Srinivasa, and then I had my ovaries removed all in the same surgery. So it was a pretty big surgery, and I'm not gonna lie, it was the hardest, darkest time of the entire process, really, because that was the first time I felt so physically terrible, you know.
Now, you know, can you talk a little bit about that, like what those 3 weeks were like, not being at home? You know, where did you stay? Because I think a lot of people have a hard time like figuring out, like they don't have options where they live or great options, and they want to travel, but they're really nervous about what all those logistics
are. Yeah. Like. So was I. I was like, how in the heck does a mom of three leave her house for 3 weeks? Like, this is not going to work. So, well, first of all, Dr. Srinivasa's team like helped me set up a lot of things in terms of where to stay, what I'm going to do. So 1 week I was in the hospital, and that week my husband stayed with me in LA, and then he flew home, and my sister, like they swapped so he could be with our kids. And my sister was there with me for a week. And then the third week we actually flew the kids out, and we rented a beautiful home in Malibu, and were able to like recover with this beautiful, it was so serene and beautiful. But we kind of tried to make it like a thing for them, you know, and make it like, oh, this is our vacation and you get to be with your cousin. And then my sisters ended up coming and bringing their kids
too. That's fun.
We made it like a cousin's thing. But I've talked to a lot of women who've done this. I actually reached out to several of her patients before choosing to go with her, asking them, how did you navigate this? Like, what did you do? And they were like, you know, it takes a village, but it's possible and you can do it, you know? So it just made me more motivated to make it happen, because I really didn't feel confident in doing my surgery here. It just wasn't what felt right to me.
And how did you approach those conversations with your current team? Because that's another piece of it, right? I think people are afraid or like nervous that if they don't pick the doctor that's in the team, they're going to, you know, so what were those conversations?
I actually didn't even know that that was an option at all. Like I truly was like, when I did my consultation with Dr. Srinivasa, it was truly just that in my mind, just getting her opinion. Cause I had actually, I'll share this, but I won't share names, but my surgeon here was great. She was great. She was ready to do the surgery, double mastectomy, reconstruction, all that, but it was just maybe not the way that I wanted to do it. With the expanders and like all of those things. Yeah. But there was one surgeon I consulted with that basically said, I wouldn't touch you for anything. Like I would never do a mastectomy on you because you have metastatic disease and it's going to come back anyway, is basically what she said to me. And it was devastating to hear that from a medical professional. But that's when I also realized, I mean, this is also a woman that didn't even see my chart. She had no idea. She reached out to me on Instagram and wanted to like give me a medical advice. She's a surgeon in Austin. That really affected me mentally, because I was like, am I doing the right thing? Am I putting my family through this and my body through this for no reason? Like, is she right? But then I spoke with my oncologist and she couldn't have disagreed more. She was like, I completely disagree. You are one of the few patients that, you know, either you may be in that 2% of patients that end up having no evidence of disease. We can't tell, we don't know, you know? And what I do know is you had an incredible response, and I 100% recommend a double mastectomy for you. So that's when I was like, okay, I'm doing the right thing. Dr. Christy Funk agreed, Dr. Srinivasa agreed. So I flew out there and it was the best thing I ever did.
It's so important to hear that you advocated for yourself and you're happy with the outcome and the decision. And
yeah. And to answer your question though, about how do you go about telling the team, I asked my oncologist, can I go? And she was like, you can do whatever you feel good about. Mm-hmm. And if you want me to be a part of that, I will. And she was amazing. She spoke to both surgeons and she was 100% on board. Even though she has a close relationship with the surgeons here, she was not against me going elsewhere at all.
And I think that's really important because this comes up a lot and people are nervous and scared. And at the end of the day, my take on it is it's all what's best for you as the patient. And so if this doctor or this team isn't best, like if someone gets upset about that, that's on them. Yeah. Like that's not on you.
I agree. I think that's how she felt for sure. She was mm-hmm. like, you know, this is, what are you going to feel good about? You know, you have very little control of this, the things you can control you, it's your choice. And so that made it easier for sure. But I definitely feel like people don't know that they can even consider that because I did not know that.
And what about recovery from the flap? So you had a deep flap at the same time as a mastectomy.
I did.
The ovaries. So that's a lot. That's a big surgery.
It was a big surgery. And I think I definitely don't want to paint a picture like it was easy because it was very hard. And she told me, you know, you're going to feel like you got hit by a bus when you wake up. It's going to be really hard. And I still don't think I really understood that. It's a big surgery. And the first week was super difficult. Being in a hospital, not being able to stand up. You stay in the hospital for usually, I think it's typical, is like 5 days. And that's what I did. You can't stand up straight because, you know, you're closed so tight. And it was a hard time for me because this is also when I looked my worst, like all my eyebrows had fallen out, all my eyelashes had fallen out because I did my surgery 4 weeks after I finished chemo. So it was really, I looked my absolute worst and I looked so sick and then feeling, cause I never really felt horrendous during chemo. There are so many things that you guys as providers do to prepare us for all those chemo symptoms. So I really was able to exercise throughout chemo. I was able to like be active, work, all the things like we talked about. But during surgeries, when I was like physically terrible. So I think that took me to a darker place mentally. But then it kept getting better. I did have a complication, which admitted me back to the hospital for a few days. I had an infection. And that was really hard to just feel like there was a setback. And then again, make me second guess. Should I have done this? Was this too much? Da, da, da. But then once I made my full recovery and my kids made it to LA, I actually was released from the hospital for the second time the day that they flew in. Wow. And I just remember the biggest weight being left off my shoulders. Like I freaking did it. Like I did this, you know? And we had a week there together and it was great and came back. And of course it was still hard, but around the 6 to 8 week point, which is what they tell you, you're going to see a big change. And I did. And I started exercising again by 8 weeks. So.
And it wasn't more, was it pain? Was it tightness? Was it range of motion? What was kind of the hardest physical piece of it? Once you passed that first week or two.
I think that I feel like the pain subsided after the first 2 or 3 weeks. Like it wasn't true pain. It was discomfort. It was tightness and definitely limited mobility. I felt like I couldn't do normal things both with my head. I had some cording under my right, underarm develop. I also had a lot of swelling. So that made me feel just uncomfortable. I worked with a physical therapist here in Austin pretty much about, I think I must have been 3 months out because before that I did the hyperbaric oxygen chamber, which helped a lot as well. So I was trying to do all these things to help the healing process because it's a process. It is definitely not something that happens overnight.
How did you find a therapist?
Physical therapist. Yeah. I actually, my surgeon, they did a search in Austin and found them for me. They were kind of did it all for me. But I had also looked online and there were a few places that kind of stood out that were like the main places, that do this, but I know my oncology office would have had recommendations for me as well.
Yeah. And it's an important point because it's someone who has expertise in mastectomy and reconstruction, and it's not kind of standard physical therapist who's doing hips and knees and.
Absolutely. Yeah. And like someone who's very well trained in like the lymphatic drainage process and all of those things. And she was great. She was a big part. I did that for a whole year, almost every week for a year.
talk about time commitments and, you know, one of the things I think we don't talk about enough, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it, is like the time consuming aspect of cancer care.
It's wild. It's a full-time job in itself. Mm-hmm. Just this week alone, I had an echocardiogram, which I get every 3 months. I have a PET scan tomorrow. I had a blood draw earlier this week. Last week I had my Phesgo injection that I get every 3 weeks. It's really just like almost every week there's something. It is a lot of care, especially when it comes to metastatic disease, because I won't, as of now, not be on these medications, mm-hmm. these therapies, and I won't not get PET scans, and I won't not get these echocardiograms. It's a life for me for the rest of my life.
So how have you navigated that part, you know, as well as the scans every 3 months, and how do you handle some of that anxiety that I'm sure comes up?
The anxiety around scans is very real. I think now that I'm almost 2 years out, well, I'm 2 years past my diagnosis. I was diagnosed on October 6th of 2021. So I'm past that point, but 2 years since I ended chemo will be in January. And I think the first year was every time I had a scan coming up, my mood was just I just couldn't function like normal. It almost brought you back to the original days of diagnosis where mm-hmm. you were waiting on the results or the biopsy or the, you know, but now I look at it differently. I'm like, I almost feel thankful that I'm getting scanned this often, that if there was something that it would be caught so quickly, and I'm getting monitored by the Signatera blood draws as well every 6 weeks. And I feel like I have all these tools in my belt now that I didn't have before I was diagnosed. And I feel confident in my medical team I'm going to be okay, and that we're going to catch anything if there ever is a recurrence, that we're going to catch it very early. And I feel like I look at my therapies in terms of getting the Phesgo injection, which I switched to after about a year. I decided to get my port removed, which was a little controversial, but I think for my mental health, it was an important part of it for me. And I just thought, if there's this injection, which my oncologist suggested for me, she was like, I think you'd be a great candidate for this if you want to try it. And I did. And I love it. I think it's a great option for those of us who have to stay on this long term. And don't
you still go to the infusion center? So I know sometimes they can come to your house. It varies based on where you're located and insurance.
Oh, I would have loved if someone could come to my house, but no, I still go to my infusion center, which is a humbling experience every time, because you look around and you're just like, gosh, you know, there's so many people there now that are so much younger than even when I was there 2 years ago. Like, the room used to be filled with like all elderly patients when I was there, and they would always be like, what are you doing in here, honey? You're too young to be here. And I was like, I know I am. And then now I look around the room and there's a lot of young people.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I started practicing years ago, someone was in their 30s or early 40s, and it was like, oh my goodness, you know, it was unusual, right? We had to make sure we got everyone on board. And now it's not the norm, but it's so much more common that more, you see so many younger people, and that the incidence of breast cancer is rising in people younger than 50. So it's becoming, you know, and I think it's so important to talk about it, because again, like, we come back to that awareness and the screening and the workup.
Yeah, I agree. Obviously, because I have shared so much in my journey, I hear about so much more. I'm just like, I'm sure in your field, you see, that's all you see every day, right? But almost every single woman I've been connected to throughout my process is younger than me that are being diagnosed now. Almost every single one. I can think of three just in the last month, and they're like all under 35. There's another influencer who was recently diagnosed, and she's sharing her journey publicly now as well. And I'm so proud of her for doing it, because I think it changes the face of cancer. You know, it really changes the face. I thought cancer was for old women and for, like, you know, I would have never in a million years expected this to be me, ever. And I think that's important for people to know and realize and stay up to date on everything as best as they possibly can.
So, and you're right. I mean, I think partly is a lot of people still think that cancer happens to older people, or if you don't have a family history, you don't have a genetic mutation, that you're kind of free from that. And unfortunately, that's not the case. Being, you know, as an influencer and having this really large platform, I'm curious in terms of like mental health management, is everyone obviously is reaching out to you when someone else gets diagnosed, right? Like you become kind of a spokesperson. And is that good? Is that hard? Is that bad? Like, or is it a mix of all of those things?
It's definitely a mix of all of those things. I think as I'm getting further out, it's becoming easier. And there were so many people that were there for me, and I will do the same for them, you know, for new people being diagnosed. You know, I feel like there were certain very key friends and people in my life that really stood by my side that barely even knew me, you know, and like really were kind of like a lifeline, because they had been through cold capping or they were giving me tips or whatever. So I always am, I try my very best. I know I miss a lot of people who reach out to me, but the ones that I do catch, I try really hard to be some sort of resource for them. I shared my entire journey online and I saved all of it to like highlight. So, and people always tell me I was diagnosed when I watched your story. I would never have imagined that that would have been me. And now here I am, look at me cold capping. I didn't even hear about that. I didn't know about that until I saw your story. So I think, yes, it's very difficult mentally to, because you kind of relive it every time. Yeah. You really do. I think what honestly was most hard for me was last year, where I felt like a lot of brands or podcasts or organizations kind of wanted to work together to raise awareness, which is such a great positive thing, right? But I kind of reached a point last month or last year in October that I was like, I didn't sign up to be the face of breast cancer. It's very hard to, I remember seeing my face on all these campaigns for breast cancer awareness. And I almost don't recognize myself. And I'm like, it was hard to think like, how is this my life now? But I think with time it's getting easier, and I do believe that a big part of my story is helping others. I know that in my heart. And so I feel more ready to do that now than I was a year ago.
Well, and I think that's the big part, that there is a point at which you are able, not that you're removed because you're living it every day, but you're a little bit further removed from that acute diagnosis, those emotions, and they change with time, you know. Yeah,
they definitely do.
And so I think also I always tell people, like, when you're diagnosed, you don't have to share right away, like you didn't, you know, and wait till you know what you're going to share. Did you get a ton of unsolicited advice or opinions? I'm sure we talked with the doctor who reached out to you, but I'm sure there were a lot more.
There were a lot more. And I think majority of people come from a good place. But, you know, I read something the other day. It's like things you don't say to somebody who's diagnosed with breast cancer. And one of the things that was hardest for me is like, my aunt died of breast cancer. My sister died of breast cancer. My mom died of breast cancer. Like everybody, and they were sharing that with me so that they could relate to me. But in a way, it was like so much, it was like, oh God, that's going to, you know, it was just a lot. You hear a lot more negative stories than you hear positive, right? And breast cancer, especially metastatic breast cancer. And I think there was a lot of unsolicited medical advice, people who didn't think I was doing the right thing, you know. And I
think, like you said, I think a lot of it comes from a good place most of the time. But I think partly is we don't always talk about what not to say. So people don't know what not to say, but like exactly telling someone that your family member died of cancer. Again, they're trying to sympathize, but that doesn't come across.
Right. It's like, it's really hard to hear, you know? And it's very hard not to make someone else's story your own. And I realized that the first year, because I was connected to a few different girls who were, I guess, kind of faces of breast cancer on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And within the year that I knew them, they all passed away and they all had metastatic breast cancer. And so that was really, really hard, because it's hard not to make someone else's story your own. And even though our diagnoses were all very different, our type of breast cancer was all very different, it's still hard to disassociate yourself from that. And they were all younger than me. And so it was really hard, to disassociate myself from everyone's stories. And I'm still working on that. When people come to me and they're diagnosed, I try to be supportive without taking on the grief as deeply as I was in the past. So
I think, thank you for sharing that. I think that's all really important. One last question is, when you get approached with that unsolicited advice, like, what do you say? Do you have something that, you know, other people can take and use, because I think that's where people struggle with the family members, the culture, you know, certain cultural comments, you know, all that advice that people didn't ask for and now like have to react to.
Yeah, I feel like my body language and my, I made it very clear that I had tunnel vision, mm-hmm. and I am listening to my doctors, and that is it, you know, because I had so much confidence in my medical team that I really felt I had to drown out everybody else. Even my own mother's advice, like anybody's advice, was not coming in anymore. And again, even though it comes from a good place, it can be harmful. It can make you second guess yourself. It can be all these things. And it just ended up not being good for me. So the medical advice on social media is real, though. People really, everyone thinks they're a doctor.
I'm sure I can completely see it. But it speaks to the importance of having a medical team that you trust, that Absolutely. You 100% have that, or able to have that back and forth, that conversation with, and finding the doctors like you talked about that are going to be that team for you.
Yeah. And I was not scared to get second and third opinions. I still consult with another doctor in Dallas that has never seen me physically, but has all my information. And I will continue to do that as different therapies arise and different things, like get more opinions, because I think that knowledge is power. And I think one thing I really love about my oncologist is that she's with the big group here, Texas Oncology. Her name's Deborah Papp, but she is extremely well-versed in all the things. And she wants me to have the knowledge. She wants me to get, she's like, oh yeah, go consult with whoever you want. This is your life, you know? And I think that makes a really amazing provider, empowering the patient.
She's wonderful to just begin with. Her as well. She's great. But I think that really, again, like you said, speaks to, again, being your own advocate and finding people who are going to be in your health circle that are going to help you be your own advocate.
I think that is a big part of it. And just not being scared to ask the questions. I remember in the beginning feeling scared. But then I realized like I gained confidence in myself and, you know, my providers. It's like, it's okay for me to ask this. Like, can I get a consult here? Can I get a second opinion here? You know,
it takes time. It takes time to find that to regain that confidence, right? That cancer can sometimes strip of you. Is there anything that we didn't touch on that you wanted to talk about?
I one of the things that I get asked often is where to go for resources and what I found helpful. And truthfully, and I'm not saying this because I'm a social media presence, but there are some physicians like you, Dr. Srinivasa, Dr. Christy Funk, that really put so much important information out there that I would not have known otherwise. So I think finding resources online is really helpful. And I think finding a local resource center is really great for me. Breast Cancer Resource Center in Austin is an organization that was really helpful to me in navigating different processes, like the wonders and worries for my kids, or the insurance situation. Like, oh, you just need to you don't need to deal with the insurance. Tell your provider to call this person, you know, and they would give me like the exact person's name of at my insurance to talk to, so that it would cut out the middleman. There were so many different things that were helpful along the way that I learned that I was like, gosh, I hope more people know about this. You know, there's also an organization called Immerman's Angels. And that has been really a blessing to me, because they put me in touch with another woman with my exact same diagnosis, who we probably have nothing else in common other than this, but she's 9 years out from her diagnosis of metastatic breast cancer, triple positive breast cancer. And she is just constantly a source of hope for me. Anytime I'm like having a hard day and like read something that made me spiral into something, she's been there. So anyways, there's just different organizations, but actually that brings me to one other thing is Google is not a doctor. So yes. If I went down the Google rabbit hole one more time, I might be in a mental hospital. Like, it really can bring you to a dark place. And I would just caution people to go down that route.
And that's why it is so important to have good resources online, because I think that the days of telling people don't go online or don't do your, those are gone. Like, this is not 1980s, 1990s, or 2000s. I want people to come in, you know, I will say, when people come in and they've done a little bit of, you know, reading or research, and they're like, all right, I've read about cold capping. I do want to do this. And I think you're so overwhelmed already, but I feel like you're not as caught off guard because you at least have heard some of the terms, like, you know, okay, HER2 positive, or these words that are completely new in your vocabulary. I think people are a little bit more prepared for those conversations.
I absolutely agree. And I also find out some of my newer information from people like you who are out there and sharing it, like different trials or different things. It feels like an easier way because I can't read these studies. I don't know what any of these things mean. And so for someone like you who does, to explain that to people like me, it's incredibly helpful. And so I'm really thankful, honestly, for what you guys do here, because I know I can't imagine doing this and being a medical provider in the type of medicine that you do. Like, it's a lot.
It is. But I will say that learning how to take a trial that's written in really, you know, scientific terms and translate it into what patients can't understand is a skill. And I think that at least for my patients who then come into the office, they read about it. They're prepared. Like, it makes for such a better flow in the office because they're getting that education also. Like, it's a double kind of thing.
Yeah. I love that. Thank you for what you do.
Thank you. Where can listeners find you and how can they connect with you?
So my main social media channel is on Instagram at Hey Nazreen. And I'm there every day.
Definitely follow Nazreen there. Thank you again so much for, I know this is a hard month to have these conversations, especially that's when you were diagnosed in October, but I really do appreciate you being here and being so open and vulnerable and honest.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you all for listening to this conversation. I think it is so important to talk about living with metastatic breast cancer because there are so many stigmas or misconceptions about what life with metastatic cancer is like. I'm so grateful to Nazreen for taking the time to share and to open up and be so honest about her story. And I know that it will help others. You can find Nazreen at Hey Nazreen on Instagram, as well as on her website, heynazreen.com. And as always, you can find me at Dr. Duplinski on all social media platforms. If this episode resonated with you in any way or any others of the podcast, I am so grateful if you can take a moment to leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, as that is the best way to help me grow the show, to continue to bring you incredible content, and to bring it to new listeners as well. Thank you all for being here. And remember, as we wrap up Breast Cancer Awareness Month, this movement, and remember, as we wrap up Breast Cancer Awareness Month, that we will continue to do this work all year round. Thank you again, and I will see you soon.